Now, the big read.
Gentlemen of the jury, look at this. Do you see a man sitting here? Do you see a man sitting here? I ask you, I implore, look carefully. Look at the shape of this skull. This face as flat as the palm of my hand. Look deeply into those eyes. Do you see a modicum of intelligence? Do you see anyone here who could plan a murder, a robbery, can plan anything? What justice would there be to take this life? Justice, gentlemen. Why, I would just as soon put a hog in the electric chair as this. The jury retired, and it returned a verdict after lunch. Guilty of robbery and murder in the first degree.
That's Kenyatta Rogers, reading from Ernest Gaines' A Lesson Before Dying, a novel about a man condemned to death and the teacher who helps him find dignity in the face of adversity.
What I think is so magnificent about the novel is that there's a lot more to it than just this trial. There is great resonance here.
It's like you'd think that Ernest Gaines had witnessed an execution. He got the emotions for everybody.
You have this transparent story where your heart gets brought more and more into it. And more than one mission has been achieved in A Lesson Before Dying. A lot of people learned lessons.
Welcome to The Big Read, a program created by the National Endowment for the Arts in partnership with the Institute of Museum and Library Services. The largest reading program in American history, The Big Read is designed to unite communities through great literature. Here's your host, poet, and former chair of the National Endowment for the Arts, Dana Joya.
Ernest Gaines' novel, A Lesson Before Dying, is set in rural Louisiana in the 1940s. Actress Ruby Dee.
It takes place on a plantation outside of Bayonne, Louisiana, where racism is the rule of thumb of human behavior in that part of the world. It's where slavery has taken hold. It's where the economics of life depends upon the subjugation of one group of people over another.
Rural Louisiana is also where author Ernest Gaines was born and raised.
I spent my childhood here in Point Coupee Parish. I lived on a plantation. Just like any other child, growing up on the country at that time, I did all the field work. I picked the cotton and gathered pecans and blackberries and did a lot of fishing in the bayous and the river until I was 15 years old. And the reason why I left here at that time was because there was no high school for African-American children in this parish. And my folks wanted me to be educated because I'd be the first male in our family history to go beyond elementary school.
At 15, Gaines moved to California to attend high school. There, he discovered books, a rare commodity on the plantation. Hour after hour in the Vallejo Public Library, he immersed himself in Russian, French, and American literature, anything he could find. It was also in California, living near the infamous San Quentin prison, that he became fascinated and haunted by capital punishment.
In San Francisco, you live across the bay from San Quentin, you know. And 10 o'clock on Tuesdays, this was execution day. And I always wondered, what this person must go through the month before, the week before, then the night before, knowing that he's going to die at 10 o'clock that Tuesday.
Those dark meditations about death row would eventually become A Lesson Before Dying. Editor Ash Green worked with Gaines on the book.
This young man who inadvertently gets involved in a liquor store robbery is railroaded in a trial, sentenced to death, and a young teacher is asked to prepare his way for what is going to happen to him. And the relationship between the young man who's about to die and the teacher is really an extraordinary literary feat.
The story begins with the trial of this young black man named Jefferson, Sister Helen Prejean.
What his defense lawyer does And I understand kind of why the defense lawyer did this, but what he basically said to that jury was, look at him. He's not capable of planning a murder. He's like nothing but a hog. There's nothing in that skull. Look at that face.
And in his efforts to achieve success in saving this young man's life, he demeaned him in every way possible.
Actress Cicely Tyson.
The blow that devastated his godmother, Emma, was when he was referred to as a hog. It has to tear you up inside.
After watching the boy she raised suffer this gross indignity, Jefferson's godmother, Miss Emma, makes a decision.
She had accepted the fact that he was going to die. What she refused to accept was that he was not going to die as a hog, but as a human being who is a man.
Miss Emma makes a plea to the plantation owner, Mr. Henri Pichot, whom she has served much of her life.
They called my boy a hog, Mr. Henri, Miss Emma said. I didn't raise no hog, and I don't want no hog to go sit in that chair. I want a man to go sit in that chair, Mr. Henri. He looked at her, but he didn't say anything. He was waiting for his drink. I'm old, Mr. Henri, she went on. Jefferson gonna need me, but I'm too old to be going up there. My heart won't take it. I want you talk to the sheriff for me. I want somebody else take my place. I want the teacher visit my boy. I want the teacher make him know he's not a hog, he's a man. I want him know that before he go to that chair, Mr. Henri. I done a lot for this family and this place, Mr. Henri, she said. All I'm asking you talk to the sheriff for me. I done a lot for this family over the years. I can't promise anything, he said, and sipped his drink.
Cicely Tyson appeared in the 1999 film adaptation of A Lesson Before Dying. She played the role of Miss Emma's best friend, Tante Lou.
The character, Tante Lou, probably on the exterior, appeared to be very stern and very strict. But she knew what black men had to face in that bigoted society.
Just as Miss Emma is the mother figure to her godson Jefferson, Tante Lou raised her nephew Grant Wiggins since childhood. Grant is the schoolteacher on the plantation and the man on whom Miss Emma pins her last hope. She asks Grant to visit Jefferson in jail to teach him that he is not an animal but a man who should walk to his death with dignity.
Well, there was a great deal of reluctance on Grant's part, because he said he himself was still grappling with what in fact is a man. Who in fact is a man? Am I a man? He said, I don't even know if I am accomplishing what I would really like to accomplish with these children. And that's because I'm not sure of myself. So how can I project to someone something that I am not sure of myself?
It's actually as much a struggle for Grant to understand what's going on as it is for Jefferson.
Playwright Romulus Linney adapted A Lesson Before Dying for the stage in 2000. he was struck by the story's contemporary reverberations.
How many black men are in prison now that didn't do what they're in prison for? Are you kidding? It's one of the awful, shameful things about our country. It's a great country, but it has great things wrong with it, and that's one of them. There is great resonance here. And the resonances are all about the relationship between African Americans and white people in very difficult circumstances.
Grant Wiggins, who narrates the story, describes his first visit to Jefferson in jail.
We went through a heavy steel door to the area where the prisoners were quartered. The white prisoners were also on this floor, but in a separate section. I counted 8 cells for black prisoners, with 2 bunks to each cell. Half of the cells were empty. The others had 1 or 2 prisoners. They reached their hands out between the bars and asked for cigarettes or money. Miss Emma stopped to talk to them. She told them she didn't have any money, but she brought some food for Jefferson, and if there was anything left, she would give it to them. There was an empty cell between Jefferson and the rest of the prisoners. He was at the end of the cell block and was lying on his bunk when we came up. The deputy unlocked the door for us, and Miss Emma and I went in. Jefferson still lay on his bunk, staring up at the ceiling. He didn't look at us once.
It's really a story about human freedom and choice up against great extremity and great injustice.
Author of Dead Man Walking, Sister Helen Prejean is a Roman Catholic sister of St. Joseph, whose account of her relationship with a death row inmate was made into a 1995 feature film.
Jefferson is on his bunk with his face to the wall, and he doesn't utter a word. And the first visit goes like that. Second visit goes like that. So Grant is thinking, man, this is if he won't even talk to his own mom. I mean, I'm not going to be able to get any headway.
During one visit, Jefferson intentionally behaves like a hog to upset Grant, eating his aunt's food off the floor like an animal. Grant calmly explains the despair his behavior would cause Miss Emma if she knew of it.
Grant more and more appealed to him, look at really making an Anne happy. And that's going to end up being a fulcrum of love around which things are going to pivot. Because do it for her. You owe it to her. She raised you and loves you. Do it for her.
Let it shine on me. Let it shine on me. Let your light from the lighthouse shine on me. When they give out of him, must I be carried to the sky on flower beds of Eve.
You're listening to The Big Read from the National Endowment for the Arts. Today we're discussing A Lesson Before Dying by Ernest Gaines.
Shine on me, let it shine on me. Your light from the lighthouse shine on me. Shine on me, let it shine on me. Your light from the lighthouse shine on me.
Like Jefferson, Grant is engaged in his own internal battles. He hates living on the plantation, where the only job for an educated black man is as a schoolteacher. With astonishingly limited resources and students who work the fields more often than they attend school, he has little power to affect change. Despite a burning desire to flee the plantation and the South, Grant cannot leave. He's bound by a complex sense of duty to the community in which he was raised, and he's in love with a young woman named Vivian, who's in the midst of a divorce and must stay put in order to keep her children.
We left the house. Up at the church, Reverend Ambrose had just started his termination song, Amazing Grace.
Amazing Grace.
We went down the quarter. Horses and mules were grazing in the pastures beside and behind the houses, but that was about as much movement as you saw. Above, A low, ashen sky loomed over the plantation, if not over the entire state of Louisiana. A swarm of blackbirds flew across the road and alighted in a pecan tree in one of the backyards to our left. The entire plantation was deadly quiet, except for the singing coming from the church up the quarter behind us. This was Vivian's first time back here, and I told her that my people had worked these fields ever since slavery, and many of them were buried in the cemetery behind us. I asked her if she wanted a piece of cane, and she said yes. She chewed it and let some of the juice run down her chin, the way a small child would do. I cut off a round for myself and chewed it. It was very soft, very sweet.
When not teaching, Grant spends as much time with Vivian as he can manage. He tells her about his bleak and discouraging visits to the prison. Then suddenly, Grant makes an important connection with Jefferson, Sister Helen Prejean.
Grant's big breakthrough with him comes when he brings him a radio. He had to go to trouble to get that radio. He had to have permission to get the radio. He had to borrow money to get the radio. And that radio becomes a turning point.
When I was a kid growing up, we'd go to my grandmother's house, and we used to listen to the music, especially late at night. You could hear this blues and this stuff.
Author Ernest Gaines.
And the blues was reaching Jefferson spiritually. And this is the reason why I had it. It was to get him to open up.
Music reaches Jefferson in a way that nothing else had. Not religion, not his family. But the radio proves to be only the first gift that changes Jefferson's life. Grant brings him a notebook and pencil, and he urges Jefferson, who is barely literate, to try to write down some of his thoughts.
The letters were large and awkward, the way someone would write who could barely see. As closely as I could figure, he had written, "I dreamt it again last night. They was taking me somewhere. I wasn't crying. I wasn't begging. I was just going with them. Then I woke up. I couldn't go back to sleep. I didn't want to go back to sleep. I didn't want to dream no more."
I want to show his limitation in his language and words and his spelling. I wanted all of those little things going on for a person who's illiterate.
Ernest Gaines.
He never, ever thought himself as important. I'm nothing. I just obey, and like a dumb ox or a mule or whatever. I do what people tell me to do, and that's it. And then I try to turn it into who am I? And what do I like about life? How's life treated me? And he tried to put that down on paper.
Jefferson's sentence is death by electrocution, a practice that continued in Louisiana until 1991. Ash Green.
In Louisiana, in those days, when a person was sentenced to death, the electric chair was moved to his hometown so that he could be electrocuted in front of his neighbors, if you will. It was rather an extraordinary way of doing this.
Sister Helen Prejean.
Then Gaines takes us into the viewpoints from different people, the word spreading from the people that the chair had arrived, other people saying, "Oh, I don't want to see it. Oh, I can't believe they're going to do that." And the fascination and the horror that this man is going to be killed in this chair.
They did that too. They hauled it in the truck, and he brought the big generator. And I remember when I read the book, the generator, because the generator is a noisy, loud thing, and they use an old tractor motor to run a generator.
Burl Kane is the warden of Angola State Penitentiary,
where all executions in Louisiana now take place. These days, the state uses lethal injection for its executions. The traveling electric chair now sits in Angola's prison museum. Warden Kane.
When the switch is pulled, then the engine, it's like when it's strained and the governor kicks in, it revs the engine up. It'll be, and they pull, turn the switch out, and it idles back down. And so you can actually tell when it's doing its job.
Warden Kane has witnessed 8 executions, 6 by lethal injection and 2 by electrocution.
My role has been that I'm going to be the one that walks in there with him, that talks to him and give the signal. I've held 4 of them's hands, when they died because they didn't want to hold their hand because they're reaching to the next earth. It's crazy. I revisited all of them when I read the book.
Gaines' novel deals with the harsh realities of capital punishment, not a common theme in contemporary fiction. Warden Kane describes everyone's fear that at the last moment, the prisoner will not be able to walk on his own.
It's a cop-out, probably, when I think about it. But you just can't hardly bear to have to carry him down there and fight with him and struggle and tie him down. And what if the witnesses see that struggle? And this is traumatic for everybody. It's just rough. That's what it is.
That's a huge thing for all the people. I've accompanied 6 people to execution. I want to walk. Sister, pray God holds up my legs. I want to walk to my death like a man.
Sister Helen Prejean.
And Ernest Gaines captured that. He captured that in that book. It came so close to the actual experiences I've had in the death house. I said, Ernest Gaines, I don't know if you've ever walked in that place, but boy, you've captured it in this story.
Although Grant helps Jefferson develop his humanity, the teacher is unable to bring himself to be with the condemned man during his final hour. He's at the church school instead, walking outside while inside his students kneel in silent prayer.
I had no idea what I would do while I waited to hear from Bayonne, but I found myself out in the road and walking up the quarter. It was a couple of minutes after 12, and I was trying not to think. But how could I not think about something that had dominated my thoughts for nearly 6 months? It seemed I had spent more time with him in that jail cell than I had with the children in the church school. Why wasn't I there? Why wasn't I standing beside him? Why wasn't my arm around him? Why? It must have been 12:15 by now. I didn't want to look at my watch anymore. Had it already happened, or was he still waiting, sitting on the bunk, hands clasped together, waiting? Was he standing at the cell door, listening for that first sound of footsteps coming toward him? Or was it finally, finally over?
Oh, death is awful. Death is awful. Death just ran me over another year.
Ernest is one of the finest writers the country has ever had.
Romulus Linney.
At his best, as he is in this book, there's a love of life, in spite of what life does to you. There is a love of human expression that soars above the story. If you want, it's about goodness.
Cicely Tyson.
What I get is a lesson on how to maintain your pride and dignity, no matter what the circumstances are. And you are able to do that when you understand who you are.
Ruby D.
The message is something that you think you've known as a black person for a long time, but he gives it clarity. He gives it an undeniable sense of truth. He dimensionalizes racism, knowing that if you can analyze something, you can understand it better. When you can pull something apart and look at it, it's not as fearsome.
Today, Ernest Gaines lives in a house that he built on the same plantation that he worked as a child. He bought the land when he returned to Louisiana after his years in California.
The body went to California, the soul remained here with my aunt and my brothers and sisters and the old shack we lived in. And we have a cemetery back there where my people are buried the last over 100 years.
Many readers assume that Gaines's portrayal of Grant Wiggins is somewhat autobiographical, a point that the author denies, but that intrigues him.
Grant knew who he was. He just hated where he was, but at the same time, he can't leave. I don't know what would have happened to me had I stayed here. I probably would have ended up teaching his granddad in a little school like this, you know, or somewhere, and angry. I've said it quite a few times that the two best moves I've ever made in life were the day I went to California and the day I came back here.
I think what's important about Gaines is that he can be read with equal profit by a 12-year-old or a 60-year-old.
Ash Green.
And not many American writers of fiction reach those multiple kinds of audiences these days.
Gaines recalls an encounter years ago when another writer asked him for whom he writes.
I say, well, learning from so many people, I don't write for any particular group. And he said, well, so well, the gun was put at your head. I said, well, I write for the black youth of the South to help him find his way and know something about his past, so maybe it'll help him in his future. And he said, well, the gun was still at your head. I said, well, let's say that's right for the white youth of the South, to let him know that unless he knows something about his neighbor over the last 300 years, he knows only half of his own history.
Oh, when them cotton bowls get rotten, you couldn't pick very much cotton in them old cotton fields at home. It was down in Louisiana, just a mile from Texarkana, and the more cotton field at home.
Thanks for joining The Big Read. This program was created by the National Endowment for the Arts in partnership with the Institute of Museum and Library Services. It was written and produced by Molly Murphy and Dan Stone and mixed by Molly Murphy. Readings from A Lesson Before Dying were by Ken Yotter Rogers. Were You There? Guitar Man, John Henry, Piedmont Melody, and Amazing Grace by NEA Heritage Fellows Cephas and Wiggins, used courtesy of John Cephas, Phil Wiggins, and Joe Wilson. Cotton Fields, Leaving Blues, Let It Shine on Me, and Moanin', performed by Leadbelly, plus Death Is Awful by Doc Reed, all used with permission of Smithsonian Folkways Recordings. Original sound effects by Brett Finley at Sonic Magic Studios. Production assistant, Adam Campy. Administrative assistants, Pepper Smith and Erica Koss. Special thanks to Ken Huffman, Lois Harris, Kit Pornell, Sister Margaret, Latifah Martin, Angie Norwood, and to our contributors, Warden Burl Kane, Ruby D., Ernest J. Gaines, Ash Green, Romulus Linney, Sister Helen Prejean, and Cecily Tyson. For the National Endowment for the Arts, I'm Dana Gioia.
It was down in Louisiana, just a mile from Texarkana, and the old cotton field at home.
For more information about The Big Read, go to www.neabigread.org. That's www.neabigread.org.